From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, cancer researcher Mel Greaves discusses cancer and its treatment from an evolutionary perspective. He says that to understand cancer, you need to understand evolutionary biology. Genetic mutations have enabled humans to evolve, but genetic mutations can also cause cancer and can affect the outcome of treatment. Mel Greaves is the author of Cancer, the Evolutionary Legacy, and director of the Leukemia Research Center at the Institute of Cancer Research in London. Also, classical music critic Lord Schwartz reviews the Dresden Music Festival and discusses the German city, which is still recovering from the Allied bombings of World War II. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. A former spokesman for Kenneth Starr has been charged with criminal contempt and ordered to stand trial next week in a case involving news leaks during the Monica Lewinsky case. The Associated Press cited court documents saying that Charles Bacalli, who is a spokesman for the former independent counsel, faces trial over statements he made in connection with alleged news leaks during the Lewinsky case. Much of the case centers around sealed documents, and the federal judge who will be presiding over the trial oversees matters involving grand jury secrecy. The trial has been set for July 13th. President Clinton's disbarment case in Arkansas still hasn't been assigned to a judge. Four judges have recused themselves because they have ties to the president. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
The four judges are all Democrats, and they say they have political ties to the president that would make it inappropriate for them to rule in a case calling for Mr. Clinton to lose his license to practice law in Arkansas. A fifth judge now has the case. Leon Johnson was appointed by a Republican governor on June 2nd, but Johnson says he has not yet decided if he will take the case. The lawsuit against the president was filed by the Arkansas Supreme Court Committee on Professional Conduct. It says Mr. Clinton is unfit to practice law because he gave deceptive testimony in the Paula Jones sexual harassment case when he was asked about his relationship with Monica Lewinsky, the former White House intern. Mara Liasson, NPR News. The White House.
Authorities in Northern Ireland have banned a second Protestant parade after a surge of violence that has shaken the fragile peace process. Police and troops have been deployed in Belfast and around Drumcree in the town of Portadown. Marianne McGuire reports from Drumcree.
British troops had been off the streets for over 2 years. They were called in by the police, who asked for extra support. The move follows 3 nights of violence. Hardline Protestants supporting the Orange Order are furious at a ban that will prevent a controversial march from entering the Catholic neighborhood of Portadown. The British Army has also said that in the past 24 hours, there have been more outbreaks of civil disorder than in the whole of last year. In Belfast, there was more violence. On Drumcree Hill in Portadown, a huge military barrier was erected on the bridge leading to the Catholic neighborhood of the town. For NPR News, I'm Marianne McGuire in Drumcree.
Stock prices came to a mixed close today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 2 points to close at 10,481. Advances led declines by 4-3 in moderate trading. Volume on the New York Stock Exchange was 945 million shares. The average price per share gained 5 cents. The NASDAQ Composite Index gained 97 points, or 2.5%, to close at 3,960. This is NPR News. A tug and barge company from Stamford, Connecticut, says it will take responsibility for cleanup of an oil spill off the coast of Rhode Island. Ebong Udama reports from member station WSHU.
The Coast Guard says 5,000 gallons of an oil-water mixture has been recovered so far from a 9,000-gallon fuel oil spill in Narragansett Bay. The accident happened when a tug owned by Penn Maritime of Stamford, Connecticut, collided with the oil barge it was towing. The barge contained 3.8 million gallons of oil. Coast Guard Petty Officer Andrea Stevenson says the spill has affected some local wildlife.
5 swans have perished as a result of the spill, and 50 geese from southern Prudence Island have been reported to be oiled.
The Coast Guard is crediting the barge operators with quickly transferring oil from the damaged compartment to undamaged holds and avoiding a bigger disaster. For NPR News, I'm Ebong Udama in Fairfield, Connecticut.
The Yugoslav parliament has approved constitutional changes that would allow President Slobodan Milosevic to run for another term in office. Milosevic's term is set to expire next year, and because he was elected by parliament, he's not eligible to run for re-election. The change calls for the president to be elected by popular vote. Since Milosevic's party controls the Yugoslav media and state institutions, he'd have an advantage in a popular election, even though his popularity has fallen since last year's NATO bombing of Yugoslavia. The parliament also agreed to the direct election of deputies to the upper house of parliament that would sharply reduce the number of representatives from Montenegro, whose government has been moving toward independence. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing soy and a variety of soy products to consumers around the world. ADM Supermarket to the world. On the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Dr. Mel Greaves is a cancer researcher who would like to answer these questions. Why does a healthy body get cancer? Why do so many things appear to cause cancer? Why does it often take decades to emerge? Why does treatment sometimes succeed and other times fail? He says that to answer these questions, you need to understand our evolutionary history. Mutations have enabled human beings to evolve. Genetic mutations can also cause cancer, and genetic mutations can affect the outcome of chemotherapy. In other words, Grieve says, the perspective that best explains cancer is a Darwinian evolutionary picture. Greaves directs the Leukemia Research Fund Center for Cell and Molecular Biology at the Institute of Cancer Research in London. He's also the author of the new book, Cancer, the Evolutionary Legacy. The evolutionary analysis of cancer focuses on what survival mechanisms in the body allow cancer cells to survive.
Well, that's right. I mean, I think that what the evolutionary picture gives you is an understanding of why we're vulnerable to cancer. If you address the question or ask the question, why is there so much cancer about? Part of the explanation must be for biological evolutionary reasons. We've been set up. There are reasons why cells and genes are vulnerable to cancer. And then the evolutionary perspective tells us why human behavior has changed the way that it has and why we've been moving, socially speaking, fast track, but our genetics moves very slowly. So we now have what I think for cancer and for many other diseases is a mismatch between our nature and our nurture. And cancer is one of the consequences of this.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean that our genetics has programmed our physiology in our body to behave in a certain way in essentially a Stone Age existence. But our whole behavior and our social structures affecting our diet and our reproduction have, of course, changed out of all proportion. But normally in the wild, when animals change their behavior for a different lifestyle, it goes along with genetic changes and through natural selection. But we've changed rapidly, very rapidly, over the past 5 to 10,000 years, and particularly over the last 100 years, our social patterns of behavior and the stress that we give to our tissues. And of course, our genes can't keep pace with this. We're not genetically adapt for these stressful type of exposures, particularly as we're now living very much longer. So there's a mismatch between our genetic equipment, which equips our physiology to respond and to repair DNA, and the type of exposures, natural exposures, that we now give ourselves, not just toxic exposures through synthetic chemicals, industrial pollutants, but natural substances in food and changes in reproductive habits. And our normal hormones, which should be innocuous and beneficial, can become dangerous under these circumstances.
How does the Darwinian picture explain the cell mutations that become cancer?
Well, the thesis there is, first of all, that somewhat paradoxically, the way we've evolved over literally a million years is that our DNA is somewhat mutation-prone. And from a Darwinian evolutionary point of view, it makes sense that our DNA isn't sacrosanct, that it can mutate occasionally. Otherwise, there'd be no evolution, no selection. So DNA is intrinsically vulnerable. Then it turns out that cells in our body, or certain cells in our body that have been around in creatures for about 500 million years, are programmed to have cancerous proclivities or activity, to migrate, to move around, to clone, and so on and so forth. So rather surprisingly, perhaps, for your listeners, our bodies have cancerous credentials. Now, these are normally under control, but if Darwinian selective pressure gets a chance to operate, survival of the fittest, then a mutant clone can become the fittest, and it will tend to dominate the body.
Do you think that the ability of individual cells to mutate and become cancer cells is a mistake in the way we were made, or is it the same mutation process that has enabled us to evolve? Is this just like the downside of the thing that has enabled us to evolve?
Yeah, I think it's the latter, Terry, that it's a trade-off. And if you like, it's a design fault, that in terms of the original evolutionary setup, it was beneficial to have at least a low rate of mutation and to have cells behaving the way I just described, territorially as cancerous cells. And as long as this is kept as a low level and we don't live for too many decades, that's all, so to speak, under control and causes no havoc. Now, the problem comes when those activities become unleashed and when more mutations happen than should occur. And when we live longer, there's more opportunity then for these clones to expand, to express their malignant activities.
Now, you say that to generate a fully fledged cancer cell, a cell has to subvert multiple rules of engagement and negotiate major evolutionary bottlenecks. So what are some of the obstacles that a cancer cell faces in order to survive?
Well, not surprisingly, because cells and genes have got these intrinsic fallibilities, there are lots of safety nets built into the program of cells in our bodies. For example, one of the things that would tend to restrict or prevent a cancer cell emerging if it has a mutation that compels it to divide more quickly is that as cells divide more quickly, there's a built-in negative response that compels such rapidly dividing cells to die. So for cancer cells to escape and divide continually, they almost certainly have to subvert this cell death protective process that we call apoptosis. So you need additional mutations in the cell death pathway so cells are not forced to pay the penalty of cell death when they divide. And then there are territorial restraints within tissues. Tissues are highly structured architecturally. They're not open plans. So that if cells, let's say, in the lining of the gut or the lung or the breast, start to expand as a clone of cells, a single cell clone, there will be physical constraints and physical barriers. So cells have to acquire the ability to break through in order to migrate, to degrade those types of barriers. And then there's a third level of restraint, that as cells get bigger, they run out of oxygen and nutrients, so they'll tend to die also for that reason. So another trick, so to speak, that cancer cells have to adopt if they're going to be successful territorially and expand for a period of time is they have to solicit nutrients and new growth of blood vessels that can sustain their growth. So those are three tricks of the trade, so to speak, that cancer cells have to adopt, bottlenecks in their development. And unless they negotiate really all of those, they'll not finally disseminate in the body and cause the kind of havoc we can see in the clinic.
That's why, although there's a lot of cancer, not everybody gets it.
Well, I think that, again, that there's some extraordinary things here, that I'm pretty confident that every single one of us has small tumors in our body, particularly as we age, and mutant cells in our blood and in our tissues. But the vast majority of those putative escapee clones never make the full journey. They never negotiate all the bottlenecks. And in some ways, it's surprising that we don't all have lots of cancer, but all of these bottlenecks and controls are fairly robust. So only occasionally, in a small minority of cases, a single cell, a single clone breaks through these different restraints to cause a clinical cancer.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Professor Mel Greaves, and he is the director of the Leukemia Research Fund Center for Cell and Molecular Biology at the Institute of Cancer Research in London. And he's also the author of the new book, Cancer, the Evolutionary Legacy. Do you feel like the Human Genome Project, which has mapped most of the genes in the human body, showing where each gene is located and what each gene does, do you feel that this project has contributed to our understanding of cancer and our ability to create treatments for it?
Well, that's an interesting and, in a way, quite a controversial question. First of all, the Genome Project and the announcement recently that the provisional map is going to be available very soon is a tremendous tour de force. It's a wonderful achievement of human ingenuity and technology. But on the other hand, I personally think some of the claims for it are a little extravagant, and I'm a bit concerned there may be unrealistic expectations raised for patients and their families about rapid remedies. I mean, there are two sides to this coin, if I can just elaborate a little bit. First of all, as far as understanding cancer is concerned, identifying mutant genes is extremely important. And what that has already given us, and will give us even more with the Genome Project, is a detailed audit or listing of the mutant genes in human cancer. And the main benefit there might well be in more accurate early diagnosis. And accurate early diagnosis could make a huge impact on curability, because cancer is almost invariably curable when it's caught early enough. But one of the major claims of the Genome Project, other than the somewhat absurd claim of immortality that you might have heard, is that we're going to get new cancer drugs. Now, that might be the case some way down the line, 5, 10, 15, 20 years. But I think it's a little naive to expect that that will be rapidly forthcoming. And I say that because we already have quite a lot of knowledge of mutant genes in cancer. And the problem for us, or the bottleneck now for the clinicians and the oncologists, is not so much having mutant molecules to aim our new therapies at. There are huge problems in delivery of new drugs. And there's a huge Darwinian problem, as I discuss in the book, that by the time cancer cells become resistant to conventional treatment, they are so multiple in number, they are so diverse genetically, that they have ways of escape which parallel antibiotic-resistant bacteria. So these problems will still exist. I think the Genome Project is tremendous. We're all excited about it. We'll all exploit it. But we have to wait a while for the genome to give us the details we need. There's a huge gulf between having sequential gene information in a map and understanding function and abnormalities in cells.
Some people have an inherited predisposition to cancer, and I guess the Human Genome Project will help us understand that. But you say that most of the cancers really aren't inherited. The genetic mutations are ones that have happened within the body, not programmed from birth.
Yeah, that's another important point, because I think people are sometimes not misinformed, but they misunderstand this point about the role of genetics. I was in a cab, a taxi in Minneapolis last year when the driver told me that she thought breast cancer was inevitable because it's in your genes. And this suggests that people perhaps have got an overestimate of the inherited genetic component. I mean, I think the truth of the matter is that about 10% of cancers overall are caused by inherited mutant genes. Now, 10% is a fair number of people, so that's important. And the Genome Project will help identify all of those genes so that we can screen people and perhaps take appropriate measures. But for 90% of us, the cancers are caused by mutations that arise sometime during our lifespan. Now, there's one other aspect to the Genome Project and genes predisposing to cancer, which is that we all inherit genes that help us to detoxify chemicals, that help us to fight viruses and so on. And each of us is slightly different in that respect. So the other aspect, the genetic perspective on cancer and the Genome Project, is that maybe if we had a genotype for everybody, we might be able to predict, and I think it's a very big might, who's more vulnerable than who else with respect to tobacco-induced cancer or breast cancer and so on. So that's a possibility that in addition to the 10% cancers that one can predict because of mutant genes, we might be able to look at everybody and make some very rough calculation, and I think it will be very rough, of risk estimates for particular type of cancers because of normal genes, which in their variable forms between you and me and everybody else, influence risk in the way we confront viruses and chemicals and radiation and so on.
My guest is cancer researcher Dr. Mel Greaves, author of Cancer, the Evolutionary Legacy. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Mel Greaves, the author of Cancer, the Evolutionary Legacy. There is one gene you're particularly interested in its relationship to cancer and its potential for treating cancer, and that's gene P53. What is it? What's its importance to understanding cancer?
Well, P53 was discovered serendipitously, in fact, by a colleague of mine, David Lane, some 15 years ago in London. And originally, it was discovered as a component of a virus. It turned out that this is a gene that we all have. In fact, all vertebrate animals have this gene, and invertebrates have a related gene. And this gene, or its product, which is a protein, plays an absolutely pivotal role in controlling the response of all of our cells to stress. Various forms of physiological stress or DNA damage or radiation or chemical damage. This is a molecule which senses damage to the cell and it solicits an appropriate response. And the appropriate response includes repairing the DNA damage, if the damage is too severe, compelling the cell to stop dividing or compelling the cell to die. Now, you can, having told you that, I'm sure your listeners could imagine, if you had a lesion in this protector, P53 protector of our DNA, if you were defective in this policing surface, then when your cells are damaged, you'd be really at risk, because the hazard then is the cell doesn't undergo these appropriate responses of cell death and repair. It carries on proliferating in the face of damage. And that, in essence, is what cancerous clones are. They're cells proliferating when, by all rights, they should be dead or they should be sleeping, but they carry on dividing. And a consequence of that is, or a correlate is, that in at least 50% of cancers, we see that this P53 gene is mutated. It's the most commonly mutated gene in cancer. And from the Darwinian point of view, you can sort of understand why that happens. The selective advantage for any cell that can get rid of P53 or its gene, or mutate it so it's inactive, that cell will then not be dead. It'll have a growth advantage over all its neighbors that will be dead or sleeping. So P53 is a really critical player, not the only one, but a critical player in the evolutionary development of cancerous clones. And by that token, it provides a common potential target for therapy.
Does that mean that whether you have breast cancer or colon cancer or prostate cancer, P53 might be playing a role in that cancer?
Yes, in almost all types of cancers, particularly as they evolve to a stage of dissemination from the original site elsewhere in the body, we find P53 mutations coming into play and being there very commonly.
What percentage of cancers would you say involve a problem with this P53 gene?
Well, approximately 50% have a detectable P53 mutation, mm-hmm, or loss of the gene. And in many of the others, there are other genes involved that interact with the same protection damage response pathway. So actually, in a sense, if we slightly broaden it, as far as that protection mechanism in which P53 is pivotal is concerned, probably all cancers, if they are really going to disseminate and cause the problems that we're familiar with drug resistance and dissemination, have a fault or defect in this protection pathway.
So to sum up, this P53 gene, when it's mutated, can allow a cell to keep reproducing, even though, for all practical purposes, if it wasn't for this mutation, the cell would die.
That's right, and so, it's a double whammy. It's a double whammy in the sense that in order for the cell initially, before the clinician comes on the scene, in order for the cell to grow and survive the stress of spreading around the body and all the protective mechanisms, it has to overcome this P53 protective mechanisms. But then along comes the oncologist with his drugs. Now, it turns out these drugs, as well as radiation, operate by killing cells by these same stress-related cell death mechanisms. But, of course, now the cells are already resistant. They've already been selected in a Darwinian fashion to survive the very kind of stress that clinicians try to use to control the cancer. So then you have a way of escape. It's no longer really surprising that it's difficult to treat disseminated metastatic cancers.
So you're saying that because of this mutation in the P53 gene, cancer cells might be resistant to toxic therapies like chemo?
Well, that's clearly one of the reasons why they're resistant. You can show experimentally in the laboratory that if you take cells and you cripple their P53 mechanism, that you greatly increase their resistance to standard therapies.
What are some other keys that P53 might hold for cancer treatment?
Well, there's tremendous interest here, both academically and in biotechnology industries, of way in which it might be possible, using small peptides that bind to P53, small protein molecules that might restore the normal shape of the mutant P53 to restore its function. So that's one very interesting idea that's being actively pursued.
Now, let me stop you there. Let me stop you there. If that happened, that would mean by restoring P53 to its normal function, it would prevent cells, cancer cells, from reproducing.
It might do that, but also it would then make them vulnerable to standard treatment. They would die in the face of standard treatment rather than being resistant.
I see.
The other approach, rather than restoring function, is a very interesting way of turning things around as a sort of Achilles heel, and that's to compel cells that have a mutant P53 to commit suicide. And there are some interesting new viral therapies that are in clinical trial at the moment, in which viruses going into cells that have P53 mutations, viruses carrying a suicide gene, are inactivated in cells that have a normal P53, but in mutant cancer cells, those viruses are themselves allowed to proliferate, and the consequence is they express a new type of suicide gene that kills the cancer cells. So that's another very enterprising and interesting approach. I'm quite enthusiastic about those, but the problem, again, from this type of molecular therapy is the enormous challenge of delivering these type of drugs and compounds and viruses into every part of the patient's body where they need to get.
Can you talk more about the suicide gene, like what this process of suicide is?
Well, turns out to be an extremely complex network that evolved at least 500 million years ago. When unicellular animals became multicellular animals, it was important to control cell numbers. So there had to be some balance between cell growth and cell death. So genes were modified and invented that encoded proteins that could induce cell death. Now, these genes turn out to be mostly enzymes. There's a whole cascade of them in a chain reaction, rather like blood clotting. And at the end of the line, what these enzymes do is they destroy the membranes of cells and they cut up DNA in cells so that cells can no longer function. And all cells have this built-in suicide mechanism, which may seem counterintuitive, but it makes sense as a control mechanism. And actually, that suicide mechanism will always be evoked and active in cells unless it's overruled by cells getting appropriate survival signals from their neighbors to tell the cell that everything's okay, it's permissible to divide, and so on. Otherwise, this suicide process is activated.
And P53 controls that suicide process?
It's part of the process. The control is quite complex.
Mel Greaves is the director of the Leukemia Research Center at the Institute of Cancer Research in London. His new book is called Cancer, The Evolutionary Legacy. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, what a Darwinian perspective can tell us about cancer treatment and prevention. We continue our conversation with Mel Greaves, author of Cancer, The Evolutionary Legacy. Also, Lord Schwartz reviews the Dresden Music Festival. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Mel Greaves, a cancer researcher who is studying cancer, its causes and treatment, from the perspective of evolutionary biology. Greaves directs the Leukemia Research Center at the Institute of Cancer Research in London, and he's the author of the new book, Cancer, the Evolutionary Legacy. Now, you said that one of the problems with current toxic treatments is that cancer cells can basically become resistant to chemo. And you compared it to how certain strains of bacteria become resistant to antibiotics. How do cancer cells become resistant to chemo?
Well, I think we now have a fairly clear picture of this. I mean, we talk about cancer cells as a single cell clone. They come from a single cell. It's one of the most important characteristics. And people are familiar with cloning now through Dolly the sheep and from identical twins. Have the idea that the thing about clones is everyone's identical. The cells are identical. But paradoxically, what happens in cancer, in a cancerous clone, is that as the cells multiply and divide, they become genetically very diverse, in the same way the bacteria actually become diverse as they proliferate. So by the time you have 1 million, 10 million, 100 million cancer cells in your body, although they belong to one clone, they're not at all identical. They have lots of genetic diversity, and in a way, they're genetically unstable. But what that gives them, in the short term at least, is a great evolutionary advantage. Because if you now come along with a drug which kills most of those cells, 99.99%, there will be somewhere in that million, million, million cells, one cell or 10 cells, that have mutated a gene that allows them to resist that particular toxic treatment. So it's a genetic diversity that's the trick that cancer cells use. And it would be exactly equivalent to a rapidly mutating bacterium in a natural environment or bacterium in our body facing antibiotic challenge.
Does that make a recurrence of cancer often more difficult to treat than the original cancer?
Yes, that's almost always the case, that often the therapies that we give, we see regression of the tumor, shrinkage of the tumor, or remission, and that's telling us that, again, 99.9% of the cells have been killed by that therapy. But the concern is once the tumor is advanced, and this almost invariably happens when it's very advanced, there will be these small number of mutant cells hiding in various places that are resistant to that treatment for the reasons I've just explained, and they now have an opportunity to expand. And in fact, paradoxically, those treatments, because they're generally toxic and nasty and kill a lot of cells, create the space and the environmental circumstances where Darwinian selection, as I call it, now encourages those mutant cells to expand to become the new dominant clones. So Darwinian selection works very much against the patient and the doctor in this context. Once the cancer has evolved to that stage of being very numerous and genetically diverse.
What are some of the tricks oncologists have of trying to deal with the fact that the cancer cells are so diverse?
Well, there are lots of things that can be tried with variable success. One trick is to give really enormous doses, what Americans like to call mega upfront treatment, which I find rather worrying, I have to say, because the treatments are so toxic and nonspecific. But that's sometimes advantageous. If you give enough toxic treatment, you will kill every cancer cell. The problem is, if you're not careful, you're going to kill vital cells in a normal patient. Another trick is to cycle different drugs, different combinations of drugs. And it used to be thought, not unreasonably, that if you give enough different drugs, it was unlikely there would be mutant cells that were mutant and could resist many different types of drugs. But then it turns out something that maybe we should have guessed, but something that works against us as well, which is evolutionary. And that's that the drugs we use in the clinic are mostly derived from natural substances. They're types of chemicals that exist in the wild, particularly in plants, but elsewhere. And over millions of years, our cells have acquired simple chemical tricks for getting rid of these drugs, of pumping them out of cells, for example. So what now happens when you give multiple different drugs, there may be a cell that's a mutant in, for example, the protein pump that sends drugs out of cells, multiple different drugs. These are very common sort of garbage collection efflux mechanisms that cells have had for millions of years. So the drugs we use, because they're nonspecific, because they're toxic, are fairly easily dealt with by some cells. And a mutant cell that acquires an additional extra efficacy in getting rid of drugs is going to have a huge advantage. So that fools the clinician, unfortunately, with these multiple drugs. So in a way, what we need is either to get in early, before the clone is diverse, And early diagnosis, as I think is well recognized, can lead to cure in almost all cancers. Or we need some forms of treatment that can get around this type of genetic diversity.
Is what you've told us in the past couple of minutes applicable to radiation as well as chemo?
Yes, there are the same problems, particularly with the P53 gene we were discussing, because it governs the cell response to radiation therapy. That radiation therapy early on in the evolution of a cancer clone will be much more effective than later, for the same reasons as we run into problems with chemicals.
Mm-hmm. So do you think that the treatment for cancer will eventually deviate from the course we're on now of chemo and radiation and head for a completely different type of treatment?
Well, Terry, I certainly hope it does, and I think most of your listeners would hope it does. I mean, to be blunt about this, the treatment that we use for cancer now is not enormously different from what was used by the ancient Greeks 2,000 years ago. Poisons and gross surgery, mastectomy and so on. And we really have to get smarter than this. And the treatment, although, to be fair, is sometimes effective, and there are some wonderful success stories, particularly in childhood leukemia, where my own interests are, and a few other cancers. For most cancers, this is very crude, toxic, nasty treatment. So I'm fairly confident in predicting, as are, I'm sure, many of my fellow scientists, that 20, 50 years from now, we'll have very different ways of dealing with cancer. But, you know, I don't think it'll come from any magic single bullet through the Genome Project or anything else. And, you know, we could discuss the ways in which I think cancer might be controlled in the future, but it won't come from any single magic bullet.
Before I ask you about that, I think a lot of our listeners will be thinking now, does this mean that the doctor on Fresh Air recommends against chemo and radiation for people who have cancer today? Do you?
Well, no, I don't think the doctor does. I mean, I have enormous sympathy, without wishing to sound patronizing, to oncologists. I mean, they have to deal with the best they have available. They have to offer patients the best hope they can give them. And the best thing available at the moment is, it so happens, rather toxic treatments, which at least the supportive care for dealing with that and for the side effects is now much better than it used to be. But I think your oncologists, if you were to ask them, would say, yes, they're crying out for less toxic, more biologically focused, more specific treatment for earlier diagnosis where less toxic treatment will be necessary.
If you had cancer now, would you go for chemo and or radiation?
I'd take into account the sort of cancer I have, because cancers, here's another confusing point for listeners perhaps, but cancers vary enormously in their aggressiveness and their natural history and their behavior and their response to drugs. There's a huge difference between a leukemia and a melanoma, for example. So I'd take into account the sort of cancer I had. I'd take into account the stage of the cancer. But I suppose that the acid test for me would be, supposing I had a very advanced malignant cancer, it would be a toss-up. It would be a close call between having some horrible treatment that would reduce the quality of my life and going for a possible cure. And I guess when the chips are down, you go for what's available. You go for the toxic treatment, and you grin, bear it, and try your luck. But what I would expect is the oncologist to say to me, look, here are the pros, here are the cons. Here's your percentage chance of doing well here. Here's the risk, and here are the side effects. And I try to make a balanced decision with the help and advice of the oncologist. But, you know, it really isn't an easy decision.
My guest is cancer researcher Dr. Mel Greaves, author of Cancer, the Evolutionary Legacy. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Mel Greaves. He's the author of the new book, Cancer, the Evolutionary Legacy. He's the director of the Leukemia Research Fund Center for Cell and Molecular Biology at the Institute of Cancer Research in London. What is the potential treatment for cancer that is being researched now that you're most optimistic about?
The most promising treatment for me, putting on one side future genetic approaches that are blue skies research we don't know about, but the most promising current approach biologically that I see on the horizon and in the clinic is what I like to refer to as a Darwinian bypass. And I call it that because it gets round the problem we were just discussing of cancer cells being diverse and resistant to toxicity and having ways of escape. And an example, a very good example of a Darwinian bypass, is to aim the therapy not at the tumor cell itself, but at the territory or landscape through which the cancer cell has to travel to be successful. And one of the things the cancer cell has to do, and one of the journeys it has to make, is to solicit new blood cell formation, new blood vessel formation around it to provide sustenance and oxygen and nutrients.
To feed the tumor.
To feed the tumor, exactly. And this is a process that's called angiogenesis, new blood vessel formation. And a tumor needs that to grow beyond a certain size, where it initially arises. It also needs new blood vessels to grow in secondary deposits in the bone or in the brain or elsewhere. So then there's an idea that a number of people, Judah Volkman in Boston at Harvard in particular, have proposed and are now putting into trial, which is maybe you can aim drugs and therapies of various kinds at newly growing blood vessels rather than the tumors themselves. And this is, I think, in principle, a very rational, smart idea. For one, as I've already said, it gets around the problem of tumor diversity because it's not aimed at the tumor cells. Secondly, from the point of view of specificity, we don't normally need dividing newly formed blood vessels in an adult, in fact, other than in pregnancy. In fact, they're a nuisance in arthritis and diabetic retinitis. So we have a potential for real specificity. And thirdly, the delivery problem, that's a real bugbear for cancer treatment drugs, is much less of a problem with aiming therapy at blood vessels because they're accessible by their very nature in the blood. So there are at least three major advantages of aiming therapeutic compounds at dividing newly formed blood vessels necessary for the sustenance of tumors. And those drugs are in clinical trial, particularly in the US, but elsewhere. And in animal model systems, there's a great deal of promise. Now, again, we'll have to wait and see. These things are always more complicated and more difficult to translate into huge clinical benefit. But that's where my money is at the moment.
From what you've been describing, early detection is crucial in cancer treatment. To find the cancer before the cells have diversified more, before natural selection has made the strongest cells the dominant ones, are there new early screening methods in the works now that would help us find cancer in its really early stages?
Well, yes, there are. I think there are quite exciting developments here technologically, very dependent upon advances in molecular biology and molecular genetics. And again, the Genome Project will interact with this and facilitate this process. Of course, we've had screening methods in the clinic for some time. The Pap smear for cervical cancer has been very effective. There is screening now for prostate and breast cancer. But the problem with those, particularly the latter two, is they're not smart enough. They're rather clumsy, rather crude diagnostic techniques. They're not very predictive of the malignant behavior of the tumor, and they're not very sensitive either. What we need are smarter screening techniques that can look at, if you like, the molecular mutant profile of the cancer cells and make some intelligent prediction about the behavior of that clone and whether it's likely to spread, whether it's likely to be resistant to drugs, particularly in the context of breast and cancer, because you know, if the decision is faced by the patient and the clinician of removing a breast and removing the prostate, there are major consequences of this. And we're not very good at the moment at saying what the biopsy result means. And what we lack is the molecular audit. But this is coming on stream now, now that we know what genes to look at, now that we have something of an audit, albeit incomplete at the moment, of mutant genes. So if we have ways of picking up these smaller mutant clones and making sensible predictions about their likely behavior, I think we'll be much better at following up screening, picking up in a more sensitive way potentially malignant clones and introducing treatment selectively where it's required early on.
What would you like to be able to predict about cancer cells?
What I'd like to be able to do is first of all, if I thought a patient had breast cancer or head and neck cancer, let's say breast cancer, that I had some way by screening to survey the whole tissue at a very sensitive level to see how many mutant clones are there beyond a certain very small size. Then I'd like to be able to interrogate in a biopsy that mutant clone and to ask, well, how mutant are you? Are you a sort of minor adolescent type of mutant clone, or are you a clone with multiple changes that looks as though it's ready to cause trouble? And if it's the latter, I know I have to adopt fairly radical remedies to get rid of you. The surgery would have to be more radical. And armed with that information, I would then ask, well, here's a mutant clone that looks troublesome within the breast. Does that mutant clone already exist in the local lymph node and in the bone marrow? We now have very sensitive molecular techniques for that. If I found that mutant clone elsewhere in the body, then I'd be much more inclined to introduce systemic treatment with its potential side effects, but hopefully less toxic treatment in the future.
Now, what about prevention of cancer? Are there new things that you would suggest, or new things that scientists have learned about diet?
Well, I think this is a terribly important question. Sometimes when we discuss the cancer issue, you'll have polarized views that we need gene therapy or it should be all prevention. And really, I think a sensible view of this is that we need all of these things. We need early diagnosis. We need better non-toxic treatment, more biological treatment for advanced disease. And we need prevention. I'm really convinced that in the future, it'll be a combination of all of those things that enables us to defeat cancer over the next 20 to 50 years. But prevention, I think, is incredibly important. And it's one of the great ironies of all of this magnificent cancer research and cancer biology and genome project that we could prevent 50% of cancers tomorrow if we had the will to do so, because we know the causes. And your listeners will be very familiar with the fact that cigarette smoking is the major single cause of cancer. And so in a way, we could control that immediately. And it's somewhat obscene that so many millions of people are going to be dying of cigarette-related cancer over the next 20 years, despite our knowledge of this. So cigarette smoking is the single most important cause, not only of lung cancer, but of throat and oral cancer, esophageal cancer, pancreatic cancer, and renal cancer. And if I can just mention a couple of other behavioral, social aspects that relate to prevention. Melanoma is probably the most rapidly increasing cancer in young people at an alarming rate. And there's really no dispute about what's causing this. It's the vain tendency we all have to like to acquire suntan, to roast our bodies, our white, pale-skinned bodies, in the midday sun. You're familiar with the expression of Noel Coward that mad dogs and Englishmen go out in the midday sun. And it's quite clear that melanoma rises primarily as a consequence of ultraviolet rays mutating genes in cells that make melanin pigment. And this is why dark-skinned individuals are less at risk. Melanoma is a preventable cancer, and it's an awful, aggressive, difficult cancer to treat once it takes hold. But, you know, rather than thinking about how to treat a disseminated melanoma, we should just be stopping it. But as you were asking me about diet, and there's pretty good evidence. It's not conclusive, and epidemiologists argue about this. It's incredibly difficult to study diet, particularly if you're asking people about their diet 20, 30 years ago when cancers may have started. But on the whole, the evidence suggests that one of the problems we have in developed affluent societies, as in the US and in Europe, is particularly early in life, in teenage years and as young adults, we have too much energy going in and too little energy going out. And what this excess of calories does is it partly gets put into fat, which gives us problems with obesity, and there are health problems there, of course, but it provides more energy for cells to divide and more hormones to persuade cells to divide, and there's less cell death. So cell proliferation is actively encouraged under these circumstances. And there are other unexpected things as well. It turns out with an energy-rich diet, estrogen levels in young women are increased. Puberty is reached at an earlier age. And in the wake of that, there comes problems with breast cancer in particular. There are other aspects of diet that are incredibly important, whether there are sufficient antioxidants in the type of diet we have, which is a very exotic, abnormal diet in evolutionary terms for primate apes. There's not enough roughage in it. Although people argue about this, there's little doubt that roughage is one of the components in our susceptibility to colon cancer. So looking at it in the round, our diets are extremely abnormal in the evolutionary context. They're dictated more by economic pressures and style and fashion rather than by bodily needs.
I want to thank you so much for sharing some of your information about cancer with us. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mel Greaves is the director of the Leukemia Research Center at the Institute of Cancer Research in London, and he's the author of the new book, Cancer, the Evolutionary Legacy. Coming up, Lord Schwartz on his trip to the Dresden Music Festival. This is Fresh Air. Before World War II, Dresden was considered the most beautiful city in Germany. Last month, classical music critic Lord Schwartz went to a music festival there and remembered his first visit more than 30 years ago.
One of the most moving places I've ever been to was Dresden, the civilian city in eastern Germany that the Allies firebombed in 1945. Maybe most Americans know about this from Kurt Vonnegut's Slaughterhouse 5. I spent a day there on a summer vacation trip in 1966. I was a graduate student. I wanted to go to Dresden because the museum there had two paintings by Vermeer, my favorite painter, very few of whose works survive. In those days, to get into East Germany, even for a day, you had to go through a lot of red tape. Pun very much intended. It was a bureaucratic nightmare. But it was worth the effort. The museum was exceptional, with its great Vermeers, Rembrandts, Titians, and the famous Raphael Sistine Madonna, with its mischievous cherubs leaning on their elbows and eyeing the Madonna and baby Jesus floating on a cloud. Dresden had been one of the cultural capitals of Europe, the German Paris, with its grand palaces, onion-topped church spires, and elegant promenade overlooking an elbow of the Elbe River. In 1966, the city was still in ruins. You could look right through the skeletal steeples at the ugly apartment houses going up in the distance. The Zwinger, the magnificent palace which housed the old master paintings and the famous collection of Dresden porcelain, had miraculously escaped devastation, though the courtyard was still piled with rubble. The whole city was one of the most heartbreakingly beautiful ruins I'd ever seen. When I got a call from the German National Tourist Office inviting me to join a group of media people for a 5-day junket to cover the Dresden Music Festival, I was more than just happy to get a free trip and hear some interesting performances. Dresden was a city I already cared about. I wanted to see how it was doing. East Germany, as we know, even since the reunification, is not exactly thriving. The population of Dresden has been declining. I was told, though, that the Jewish population was on the rise, that there are now some 500 Jews living in Dresden, and a new synagogue is under construction. There are at least two other sources of hope for this city. The historical buildings are being lovingly restored, or, where restoration isn't possible, completely rebuilt. "This is one of our new old buildings," our guide said, pointing out the beautiful hotel, once a royal palace, where our group was going to have dinner. There are still signs of the devastation, but the magnificence of the historical district is slowly coming alive again. The other success is the Dresden Music Festival itself. It was actually started by the communist government in 1978. One of the first buildings the communists reconstructed was the spectacular 19th century Semper Opera House, which was still gutted when I was there in 1966. This year, the festival's theme was Baroque and jazz. we saw a fascinating but hard-to-follow high-tech production of Handel's opera Xerxes, and a concert performance by the Dresden Philharmonic of Richard Strauss's mythological opera Daphne, which had its world premiere in Dresden. The conductor was Christoph Prick, who conducts in English-speaking countries under the name Peric. Let's say he rose superbly to the occasion. One of the best concerts took place in a 400-year-old church, the Annenkirche, with glowing acoustics. The performers were the Baroque Orchestra of Freiburg, maybe the most accomplished historical instrument ensemble I've ever heard, and the astounding young German countertenor Andreas Scholl, already a very big star in Europe. Chick Corea played a morning concert at the Opera House that the sellout crowd ate up, though between his unvarying up-tempo cheeriness and my jet lag, I snoozed through it. The liveliest concert took place in the courtyard of the Zwinger Palace, under a rich midnight blue sky, with the lit-up towers of the city rising above the palace walls. The lead performers were the rhythmically indefatigable 72-year-old Cuban singer Ibrahim Ferrer and 82-year-old pianist Ruben Gonzalez, the stars of the Buena Vista Social Club. 4,500 people clapped and sang along for 3 hours, and by the end, everyone was standing up and dancing in place. Even the girl reading a letter by a window in one of the Vermeer paintings across the courtyard must have looked out for a moment with an expression of sheer joy.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music critic for the Boston Phoenix. Our senior producer today was Roberta Schirach. Our engineer was Fred Snyder. Anne Maria Baldonado directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Aquellos ojos verdes de mirada serena dejaron en mi alma eterna fe de amar, anhelo de caricia, de besos y ternura, de todas las dulzuras.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Random House Inc.'s Delacorte Books Division, publisher of Tulip Fever by Deborah McGaugh, a novel about love and painting in 17th century Amsterdam. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
My bills are all due, and the babies need shoes, but I'm busted.
On the next archive edition of Fresh Air, we listen back to our 1997 interview with Johnny Cash. His 1969 concert recording, Johnny Cash at San Quentin, has been remastered and was released this week. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
A big stack of bills that get bigger each day. The county will...